This is Daniel Denver, and welcome to the long-delayed and, at least for me and my long-suffering producers, hotly anticipated first episode of The Dig, a monthly podcast on the politics of American class warfare. Mass protests against police violence have escalated a quietly growing sentiment that something is wrong with American criminal justice into a widespread certainty that it is a complete disaster. Exhibit A, the drug war, a piece of the system that a growing number of people of various political stripes believe to be both a grave injustice and an epic policy failure. According to surveys, 84% of Americans believe that the U.S. is not winning the war on drugs, and a majority now favor marijuana legalization. Even 63% of Republican millennials, a gun-toting and/or loafer-donning demographic that could certainly benefit from a bong rip, support legalizing weed. And 67% of Americans believe that government should focus on treatment rather than on prosecuting drug users. But sadly, that does not mean that most Americans actually want to end the drug war. Just about 1 in 10 want to legalize cocaine, heroin, LSD, or MDMA. The spotlight that protesters have shown on police violence and misconduct marks the opening of a new civil rights movement in the United States. But an encounter with police on the street is only the American criminal justice system's opening scene. Even a typically peaceful arrest belies the violence of what happens to people rendered invisible behind the anonymous prison walls of the carceral state, sentenced to years, decades, and lives inside the world's most tremendous system of human punishment. Mass incarceration is arguably the defining feature of American society, just as slavery once was. It's not so much that mass incarceration is a capitalist ploy, but rather that it resolves, however bluntly, some really huge socioeconomic problems, namely the mass exclusion of so many poor people, especially poor black people, from the formal labor market. The prison boom supplanted Jim Crow and became the late 20th century's most powerful tool to ensure racial segregation. As I wrote earlier this year, America is not a police state in the hyperbolic sense that law enforcement and the judiciary operate in a permanent state of exception indifferent to the rule of law, though they too often do. Rather, Americans live in a police state because policing and prisons, and of course the military, have increasingly become the defining feature of government. Chipping away and radically downsizing the carceral state means taking on not only bad cops, but challenging the cruel and feckless political elites who create the laws that police officers are sent out in the street to enforce. It's broken windows enamored politicians, after all, who ultimately directed New York police to confront Eric Garner for apparently selling loose cigarettes, and that deploys law enforcement to conduct endless and fruitless sweeps of thriving street corner drug markets nationwide. Ending the drug war, or even more minimally, ceasing to prosecute drug users, won't end mass incarceration on its own, as some seem to believe. Our prisons are not exclusively full of people unlucky enough to be caught by a cop smoking weed. Our prison systems are so full because we punish people more fiercely than most countries do for every sort of crime, from selling drugs to murder. That ending mass incarceration won't be easy, and that it requires us to rethink how we deal with people who do very bad things is something that I hope to explore in the next episode of this podcast. But for now, we're talking about ending the drug war, and things seem to be headed in the right direction. Colorado, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. have all legalized recreational marijuana. Mass stop and frisk, the tool by which so many marijuana possessors of color are caught by police, has been heavily checked in New York and is under fire in Philadelphia. But ending the drug war will be much harder than simply legalizing weed. So many seem so convinced that the drug war is a failure, yet somehow become entirely flummoxed when the discussion moves from marijuana legalization to cocaine or heroin. But you can't end the drug war without ending drug prohibition, period. Getting there will be hard, and what's been explored very little is what a legalized drug market would look like. And the answer to that question, in large part, depends on your politics. Drug war opposition has been propelled by the civil rights and civil libertarian left, on the one hand, and economically conservative but socially permissive libertarians on the right. Both sides agree that the drug war must end. But what emerges in its place is not a foregone conclusion. In this episode, we're going to allow ourselves to get a little bit ahead of political reality and ask, what would legalizing drugs actually look like? Our guests are Sharda Sekaran, the Drug Policy Alliance's Managing Director of Communications, and Jacob Sullum, a senior editor at the libertarian Reason magazine. People like me on the socialist left agree with libertarians like Sullum that drugs should be legalized, but we disagree quite a bit about what that might look like.
It's obvious that weed should be legalized and will be legalized in the United States, but why is this happening now? What do the two of you think has changed in recent years that made something that seemed like so improbable just a decade ago seem like such an inevitability today?
A drug that used to seem very strange, exotic, and scary to most people does not seem that way anymore. And the reason is that they have experience with it now. They either have direct experience with it. If you look at the survey data, it suggests that, especially if you allow for a certain amount of underreporting, that most Americans born after World War II have actually tried marijuana. And even if they haven't tried it, the vast majority of them know people who have. And they know that for the most part, they did not, you know, it did not ruin their lives. It did not harm them in any significant way. And so it's very hard, given that kind of wide experience with marijuana, for the government to continue to lie about it and to represent it as something, you know, that cannot be tolerated. So basically what this used to be a drug that was used by other people who were, you know, foreigners or people of a different race than the majority. You know, so back when marijuana was banned, it was associated with Mexicans and with blacks. But beginning in the 60s, it became a drug that was used by white middle-class Americans. You know, this is sort of the same dynamic we've seen with gay rights and gay marriage specifically, that the more experience people have with this thing that used to scare them, the less scary it seems. So it's encouraging in that sense. You have rising tolerance in both of those areas with gay rights and with marijuana, and for similar reasons, having to do with you know, people having more experience and being less afraid. But the downside of that is that drugs that remain drugs that are only used by relatively small minorities may continue, you know, being prohibited forever, and therefore it's harder to persuade people that they should tolerate this kind of behavior by other people who may fall into categories that are strange to them or scary to them.
That, I think that's a really critical point with the drug war and with, you know, discussing criminal justice reform in general. Sharda, is the sort of language that people use to criticize marijuana prohibition, which typically emphasizes the fact that it's less harmful than alcohol, that it's no big deal, that it's really just, you know, a pretty innocuous, fun thing to do. Does that run the risk of, in the long term, sort of circling back to what Jacob was just mentioning, does that in the long term run the risk of undermining arguments about ending the drug war more generally?
The people who use all other forms of drugs, you know, there are varying degrees of stigma attached to it, which are very unfortunate because it hinders us in looking at pragmatic policies. But, you know, there are some shifts in that as well. And one notable area it's almost gotten to the point of becoming trendy, is some popularizing of certain forms of psychedelics, particularly ayahuasca. And, there's lots of different media and buzz about that right now.
The Brooklyn and L.A. booms in ayahuasca journeys.
So what that does show is a potential, obviously we have a much longer way to go to have rational conversations about many other substances because people don't look at them in rational ways. It's a very personal experience. Sometimes it's something that was formed by what people saw in the media, a lot of hyperbole, maybe bad experiences that many of us have known with addiction in our lives. But the reality is that even with the most demonized drugs, the majority of people who have used them do not develop these really horrible consequences, do not even become addicted. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't focus on the realities of addiction, but to be able to talk about the non-problematic use of different types of psychoactive substances is a very novel thing for people. But there are some cracks in just, the openness of thinking about those things. And one of them is ayahuasca. Right now, what that will mean in terms of any potential policy changes, that's something to be determined. There's some interest in talking about end of life, quality of life, and possible application of psychedelics. Will thinking about the beneficial and medicinal properties of some of these substances that are foreign to people or demonized in some context mean that people will be able to look at them more rationally and not just in terms of dogma or propaganda? It could be. So I think there's as much opportunity as there are, reasons for being, somewhat some concern that the marijuana momentum won't necessarily translate across the board.
So I'd like to ask both of you, what ending the drug war full stop would look like. Is there, do you guys have sort of different models of what that might look like? Or do you see basically one certain way that it would definitely work?
Well, I just wanted to pick up on one of the pieces, the point about, all these sort of exceptions or, piecemeal changes and what do they mean in terms of the bigger picture. I mean, I work for the Drug Policy Alliance, which is, by its very nature, a reform organization. So we have a harm reduction approach to the drug war, which is we're trying to reduce the harms of drugs, but also with these really punitive, ineffective, and destructive policies. And we do things on very small scale. Sometimes it's a community-based piece. It can just be around one municipality trying to get police to stop arresting people for drug use and instead give them opportunities for accessing health services if they need it. Or it may be something just applying harm reduction in a very isolated place or at making sure that there's just a policy that is put into place for one context, for a festival, for instance, that that people are allowed to have an amnesty from any fear of prosecution so that people going to that event are able to access health services without being afraid that that'll incriminate them and they may be arrested. So there are some small pieces, and that's essentially our approach, is working towards marijuana legalization and decriminalizing other drugs, and also making sure there's maintenance available for people, so legal access to drugs for people who have a dependency or an unwillingness for whatever reason to end their drug use, that they have options for accessing, for instance, even heroin maintenance through legal channels and aren't forced to go into the underground economy, which could just put them further at risk and usually just makes them more marginal and further in danger. And then reducing the incarceration crisis in this country by diverting people and by stopping arrests of people for drug use. So I think that even though there are all these elements, different pieces at play throughout a broad spectrum of policies, that they do culminate towards something that's meaningful.
I think that, that is a really important point, that there's been progress not only around marijuana specifically, but around sort of humanizing and not demonizing as much drug users or addicts more generally. And I think we've seen that to some extent with the heroin crisis. Some people say it's an epidemic, some people not. Either way, that's a really good point. Jacob, it does seem, though, that leaves drug dealers and the drug market, the illicit drug market, as sort of the ultimate taboo that protects the continuity of the, or ensures the continuity of the drug war. the Global Commission on Drug Policy, which I'm going to probably cite a few more times just because it's so remarkably trenchant given the sort of mainstream elites who are on it. The way they put it was, quote, "Ending the criminalization of people who use drugs is vital, but it does little or nothing to address the harm associated with illicit drug markets. That harm is obviously, you know, the violence that's coursing through Latin America and has impacted U.S. foreign policy all over the world. What do we do about illicit drug markets, Jacob?"
It was striking to me that that the commission just a few years ago issued a report that was supposed to be this vigorous condemnation of the war on drugs, but they were against the war, but they weren't ready to sue for peace. I mean, peace would mean you no longer use force and violence to stop people from using certain intoxicants. That's what it would mean to stop the war on drugs. But they weren't prepared to say that. But in their more recent report, they did start to say, you know, exactly what you were alluding to, that we have to deal with these markets. And morally speaking, you know, I start from the premise that you control your own body, you control your own mind, you have a fundamental right to do that, you have a fundamental right to control what goes into your body, what affects your mind. And it follows from that that you have a right to either make these things, you know, if you're assuming you're really handy with chemicals, or to purchase them from other willing suppliers, and they have a right to sell them to you. You know, all of that seems quite plain to me. Now, I realize not to most people, but it is completely morally incoherent to say, as many Americans do, using drugs itself, especially with respect to marijuana, that is not really a crime. In other words, it's not the sort of thing you should be arrested for, right? And certainly a majority of Americans say that about marijuana, and I think a larger percentage will say that about drugs in general, that using drugs is not the sort of thing that you should be arrested for and sent to prison for. But if that's true, if that's not really a crime and it shouldn't be treated as a crime, how can it possibly be a crime merely to assist you in doing that? If anything, that's a lesser offense, right? It's like being an accessory. So the drug use itself is not a crime, then how can it possibly be a crime to help, you know, assist people in using drugs? It makes no sense. And so people who say that we should decriminalize, meaning that we should not punish use anymore, but we meanwhile have to keep the market illegal, it makes no sense to me.
Well, something that one reason I'm really excited to have you on the show is because this debate is so rare, this discussion so rarely had in any sort of depth publicly. One thing that I started thinking about when preparing for the interview is when we get to the point one day, maybe, of discussing what ending the drug war would really concretely look like, are there going to be sort of differences that come up between libertarians like you and lefty civil libertarians like myself around questions like regulation? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
yeah, and I have.
Yeah,
I love
Sharda, jump in
on
there.
That subject too.
Please, Sharda, jump in.
Well, you know, that's part of the nuance of, you know, the Drug Policy Alliance is one of those organizations that has what Jacob described as kind of an indefensible point of view around decriminalizing possession and personal use, but not taking on the full end of prohibition and having a totally unregulated or open market without criminal penalties for sales. And part of that is because we do represent a very diverse range of views on this. This is an issue that, unlike many others that are out there, there's social causes, we have a lots of complicated nuances, people who come at it from pure libertarian personal sovereignty point of view, others who come at it from a public health and social justice and racial justice framework. We have a lot of human rights advocates and others who are iffy about, you know, what the full eventual, what can we do that will end the criminal penalties and the policies that have been so destructive without putting at risk public safety and health. And some days we're working with, you know, like a PTA in a suburb, and other days we're talking to constituents and supporters and members who are fully about, you know, like there should be full legalization, that's the only answer. And we're in this position of trying to find the common ground of what we can all agree on to push forth an agenda that, you know, that ultimately is rooted in reducing the harms of the current drug war framework. So we see those already. I mean, what I think since we have a common goal, we do have common goals of wanting to see, you know, some of the explicit horrors that we experience today. And so we're able to reach common ground in a lot of different areas. I mean, Latin America is a complicated one. It is one where it's hard to imagine how you can see an end of the violence without having a total end of prohibition. But we don't have a consensus around that. All we can do is put forth that those ideas should be at the table. I mean, a lot of these, basically even exploring alternatives to prohibition, used to be a taboo. I mean, the raison d'etre for this organization at its inception was just to even open up a debate so that we could have a rational conversation about options. It's a testimony to how far we've gotten and in the global consciousness around these issues that we're now talking about what would that system and alternative actually look like. We've gotten beyond just opening up a debate, and you see that with the evolution of the Global Commission. Their position used to be, let's just put all options on the table and at least be able to talk about ending prohibition or decriminalization and all these different options. And now we're even evolving beyond that. But we will inevitably have differences in what we see as the outcome, but I think we have such a far way to go to just alleviate the gross atrocities of the drug war as we experience it today, that it's a luxury to be able to even imagine that far ahead, but we've got plenty to be able to dismantle even with our differences around the broader picture.
Well, I think, I mean, you're starting to see some of these differences come out as states legalize marijuana, and they have to decide, you know, what is our regulatory system going to look like? How are we going to tax this stuff? Who will have access to it? Under what terms? And so you do see disagreements, and there's sort of a contrast between the Colorado's approach and Washington's approach, with Washington being more sort of command and control. In a mistaken way, I think. I mean, the idea that we're going to predict exactly how much pot people are going to smoke, and we're going to make sure that we don't supply any more than that amount. It's really folly to think that you can do that. And furthermore, they are having problems now with their tax level. I mean, legal marijuana in Washington State is still a lot more expensive than black market marijuana or the stuff that you can get in dispensaries. And they have to face up to that problem, because if you legalize marijuana and you still have a black market, you're really doing something wrong. I mean, if it persists beyond, you know, the first couple of years, I mean, it would be like having people like Al Capone still selling booze, even though you legalize alcohol. You know, clearly something is wrong if the black market persists. So you have that practical argument, right, which is basically, if we really want this to work, we can't overtax the stuff. But then you also have a more libertarian argument, which is that why have a special tax to express your disapproval of this product? Why should the people who are responsible consumers, who are most of them, be punished because some people will overuse marijuana or use it inappropriately? I mean, it's the same as the argument with respect to alcohol, right? There are people who take a sort of technocratic approach to this and a utilitarian approach, and they say, well, what we want to do is we want to get rid of the harms caused by prohibition, or at least minimize those harms, but we also want to try to minimize the harms caused by drug use. And so that what that means is that if you legalize, then you have to think about, well, what's the ideal level of taxation so that we deter, you know, overconsumption of marijuana, but at the same time we want the black market to dwindle away. You know, to me, that's not a legitimate concern for the government to decide, you know, how are we going to best deter people from overusing this product? Because then you're imposing a one-size-fits-all policy on the entire market, on all consumers, regardless of how they actually behave. So instead of treating them as individuals, you're saying, we're going to, in essence, fine all of you because some of you are being bad.
Thank you both so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the first episode of The Dig. You can follow me on Twitter at Daniel Denver. That's not spelled like the city. Please subscribe on iTunes and leave us a glowing review. Thanks to my excellent producers, Alex Lewis and Jeff Brodsky, for making this sound good.